This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we're going to talk to Kristen Aptowitz. If I said that name right, Dr. Mutter's Marvels is the name of her book. Hello.
Hi, it's so great to be on your podcast.
It's so good to... That's such a weird word, podcast. Nobody even heard about podcasts 10 years ago. It's like, what's a podcast? You know, I don't know why I say that.
I've done poetry podcasts for a long time. It's a great resource.
Yeah, you write a lot of poetry. I saw that.
Yeah, that's where I sort of started, is in performance poetry. Poetry slams, to be specific, in New York City, and that's sort of where I got my first professional footing as a writer.
So one would ask, how did you get from poetry to Dr. Mutter?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Philly, born and raised there, and when you grow up in Philly, going to the Mutter Museum is sort of a rite of passage. You know, you hear about it from your older siblings, they're going to take you to a museum, there's going to be women with horns coming out of their heads, and, you know, babies in jars and stuff, and you're sort of terrified, but also very excited. And, you know, I never really thought it was a strange place until I went to New York City for college. And I was paying my own way through college. And I was always on the lookout for scholarships. And at the time I was doing, you know, a lot of performance poetry, a lot of monologue. I was getting my degree in screenwriting and playwriting. And there came this fellowship from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for the best play or screenplay based on the life of a scientist or a scientific discovery. And I thought, you know, like, I can do this. You know, I'm a nerd. I like science, and it's the first year they're offering it. I know the pool will be very small, at least. And I thought, is there a story that I would like to research and look into? And the first thing that came to mind was the Mutter Museum, because when you leave Philadelphia, it's one of the, that and the mummers are like the two things people are always asking to be explained to them about Philly. Mm-hmm. Like, what in the world's a mummer? And what is the deal with that museum? And I realized for as many times as I had gone, I didn't know if Mutter was a man or a family or an acronym. And it was the early days of the internet, so I Googled his name and nothing came up. And even to this day, he doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. And so I wrote the Gretchen Worden, who was she was the director, longtime director of the Mutter Museum. And I said, you know, I'm sort of an unlikely person to allow into your medical archives. I'm a undergraduate studying screenwriting. I run a poetry slam out of the basement of CBGB's, the historic punk rock venue. But, you know, I'm really interested in this man and if there's a story there about the founding of this museum. And in typical Mutter Museum fashion, she said, come on in. You know, that is why we're here, for people who are interested in the history of medicine. And, you know, we would love to learn from you what you learn about the man who founded our museum. And that was the first time I stepped into the archive will be 15 years ago this upcoming December. So that's how long I've sort of been involved with the story of Mutter. So I'm really excited that the book came out last year and received the attention that it did. That was very overwhelming and very affirming.
But you were, I think, 4 years old when you first went to the Mutter Museum. Four? Is that right?
I was in the fourth grade. I was in the fourth grade.
Oh, fourth grade.
So I was
okay.
9 years old, yeah. I went there, brought by nuns. and it was a profound experience, because, you know, the way I always explain to people is, you know, if a woman with a horn walks into the supermarket, right, your mother's going to be like, look anywhere but at this woman with the horn from her head, right? Anywhere you want, just don't stare at this woman.
Right.
And the Mutter Museum takes all these things you've been told your entire life not to look at and says, come closer. Like, take a close look. Really look at it and ask questions. You know, how does this happen? How do we treat it today? How did they treat it back then? Did people survive? You know, why don't I see this today? And that sort of curiosity-based connection to science was something that I had never had before. You know, science seemed to be this thing that was constantly being sort of explained to me, but it wasn't led by my own curiosity until I came to the Mutter Museum. Hmm.
So you're a very curious person.
I think so. I love nonfiction, you know, a lifelong nonfiction reader. I love true stories. And the Mutter Museum, you know, really helps you understand what is, you know, the basics, what is considered normal, by examining what's abnormal. And I really tried to use that same technique when writing Dr. Mutter's Marvels. I tried to use all of these sort of extreme situations that Mutter and his contemporaries found themselves in to sort of give the reader a basic understanding of what American history was like at that time period, both in America itself, politically and sociologically, as well as medically. And because I find all that stuff really interesting. I like looking at secret histories to sort of understand the greater history.
I love that there's a book on the cover, Diseases of the Nose and Throat. You can't help but be intrigued by this book. I mean, you look at the cover and you think, I got to read this. What this is. And it's really a fascinating book. It's, in the beginning, in the prologue, you see the this bust of Thomas Mutter. And you think, boy, it looks like, almost like Beethoven. And it's like, wait a minute. You know, it's like, it's interesting. I mean, he did, how much did he do for surgery and the medical profession?
Oh, you know, he was absolutely a transformative figure in American medicine. You know, he was one of the earliest and certainly the most ambitious plastic surgeon. Back then they called it plastic surgeon. I think today we would probably consider what he does more reconstructive surgery. He specialized on sort of radical reconstructive surgery on the severely deformed in a time before anesthesia. So all of his patients were awake. And of course, if you're awake during surgery, you rarely want to have surgery unless it's life or death. So that he got all of these people from all across the country to come to him and have these dramatic surgeries done while they were awake just speaks to, you know, how skilled he was as a surgeon, but also how he was as a human being. I mean, he was technically so advanced, you know, some of the surgeries he created in the 1840s are still being used today, primarily the Mutter flap surgery, which is used for deformities of burns.
Really?
But in addition to that, he also was this leading voice, this advocate for a patient-centric humanist vision of medicine. You know, prior to Mutter, we didn't have recovery rooms after surgery for surgical clinics. You know, after you had surgery performed on you, if it wasn't done at home, which it frequently was done at home, then you would be transported in a wagon back to your house, you know, over cobblestone streets in Philadelphia, which if you, I'm sure being a Philadelphian, you've ridden over cobblestone streets, an unpleasant experience with rubber tires filled with air. Now imagine a wagon wheel made of wood and you just had surgery done on you while you were awake. Mutter thought this was insane. And demanded that recovery rooms be built so that he could watch over his patients and make sure infections didn't spread, that fevers didn't get worse. And they refused. Jefferson Medical College, which is now Jefferson University, just didn't understand it. And so he actually took it upon himself to rent a floor above a nearby restaurant and transported his patients there so that he could watch over them. So, you know, just one example of numerous that at a time when, you know, it just wasn't done. You know, I wish that, you know, Mutter was my patient, my doctor today in the 21st century, because that's how compassionate and focused on patient care he was. You know, I think that's something we all sort of crave, which I think is one of the reasons why it's resonating so strongly with people. And I've been really surprised that a lot of medical schools have brought me out to lecture as well, because, you know, that's still something that, you know, needs to be taught to doctors. A lot of the doctors who are coming right now come from major backgrounds, so chemistry or biology, and not liberal arts. So having that innate compassion that Mutter had is something that they're really interested in teaching, because they're so used to seeing patients as problems that need to be solved as opposed to human beings that are suffering. And Mutter was really strongly attuned to that.
Well, that's what I, when I see some of these pictures, I think, well, that poor person, my heart goes out to the people that lived through this. You know, how did they get through it? How did they walk down the street without people staring at them all the time? How awful that must have been.
Yeah, they were literally categorized as monsters. Monster was a medical term back then.
Really? They really said that?
Yeah, it was just like idiot was a medical term. I mean, essentially, again, you have to think about the 19th century mindset. You know, the surgeries were only, because everyone was awake, they were only really done in life or death situations. So you could hit a level of deformity where there'd be no treatment for you, and you would just be sort of, you know, categorized as a monster, someone who has lost the visual, you know, aspect of being a human being and is without hope. And those were the people that Mutter specialized in sort of literally in their minds bringing back their humanity.
I mean, thank God there's doctors that aren't repulsed by anything. I mean, me, I would like be freaked out. I couldn't. I don't deal well with things like that too well. So,
I mean, but, no, I mean, like, you know, it was a different time back then. People ask me a lot, like, how come we don't see some of the stuff that we see in Mutter's time, right? Some of these deformities and disfigurements. Some of it is nutrition. You know, we're much better, especially in terms of with getting the vitamins and nutrition that we need. Some of it is, you know, clean water and sanitation in general really helps prevent diseases from spreading as rapidly as they did in the 19th century. Some of it is antibiotics and, you know, infections by hands and tools that now, because of germ theory, we no longer suffer as greatly. And some of it's labor, you know, labor laws. Back then, it was a real wild, wild west. And one of the stories that, you know, I found sort of most horrifying, whenever I read a book of nonfiction, I always ask myself, I can't help it, you know, like, who would I be? If I was born into this time period, which character would I be in this story? And, you know, I come from a working class background. That story is, you know, those working class girls are not often included in stories of nonfiction.
Right.
So I made a special effort to try to be as inclusionary as possible to all, you know, spectrums of people so people can find themselves in it. And for me, you know, what working class girls did to help, you know, make money for their family back then was, you know, work in matchstick factories. You know, this is a time before electricity. The matchstick factories, you know, you're talking about little tiny slivers of wood that you have to dip into phosphorus. And so women's smaller hands were better able to process it. But they had to lick their fingers a lot to keep grabbing the small pieces of wood. You obviously couldn't have, like, candlelight. It's phosphorus. So it was a very dark factory setting. They're licking their fingers all the time, and they didn't realize at the time that they were ingesting poisons. So pretty soon they would get these toothaches and these swollen gums, and then a wound would open on the side of their mouth from the chemicals they were ingesting. And the wound would grow so large it would take up the whole cheek and go so far deep you could see the bone, the jawbone and the teeth. And because of the chemicals they were ingesting, the now exposed jawbones of the deformed girls glowed greenish white in the dark. So that is horrible, but it was so common that people had a nickname for it, Fossey jaw. You know, that was like the layman's term for these enormous facial wounds that glowed in the dark. So, you know, it was a different time. Like, they were exposed to a lot more gruesome things that we are thankfully prevented from experiencing here in the first world. There's certainly a lot of the conditions the 19th century Philadelphia suffered from, the third world is still suffering from, which is why the Mutter Museum is still a place of active study in the field of medicine, because a lot of the problems that, you know, we had in the 19th century are happening in the third world, and scientists and doctors will come and examine how we handled it, Americans and specifically Philadelphians, to help treat the problem as it crops up in different parts of the world.
And I'm looking at the pictures on 203 and you know, looking at some of these, and it almost looks like something like a scene from The Walking Dead. You look at these pictures, and it's amazing that what these poor people, and they look so sad in these pictures, and you can only imagine the horror of what they went through. With their faces.
And all the Dr. Mutter's Marvels has over 80 illustrations throughout the book, and they did a really wonderful job. You know, typically with nonfiction books, they like to put, like, all of the images and sort of, like, color in one center thing. But since the images we're talking about are 19th century, they're largely black and white, and they agreed to make it look like the way I wanted it to look, which is like a 19th century medical text. So the images are distributed throughout the entire book, and you kind of stumble upon them as you would in a medical text. And all of those engraved pictures, so all of the people you see that are sort of engravings, are all Mutter's actual patients. They are images that were taken out of Mutter's only textbook. And so it's pretty amazing to know that these faces that you're looking at in this biography are faces that Mutter actually worked on.
And I like these little sayings in the beginning of the chapters from Mutter, things that Mutter actually said about the different things that he espoused, you know, things that he,
yeah,
how doctors should be. I mean, you think of doctors today, and there's such a different, physician should be a self-relying man, you know, that's one of them, and They're all spaced throughout this whole book. He must have been an amazing man. I can only imagine meeting him, what he was like.
Yeah, he did have his flaws. He was very, liked attention, very flamboyant dresser, was very vain and in some ways sort of arrogant with his opinions. It's helpful that his opinions, turned out to be correct. It makes us feel a little more compassionate, but he certainly did not make a lot of friends. If he didn't believe in what they were talking about. He had a very short temper when it came to people who weren't as innovative or up to speed on medicine as he was. But, I think that, one of the challenges I had with this story was that Mutter was on the right side of history pretty much his entire career. And it was really hard to create a character who is always right. He has a lot of faux pas in terms of how he presents himself to the community. Those were his stumbling blocks, and he was working against the clock of his own health. He had ill health his entire life and died in his 40s, which was young back then for a wealthy white man.
Right. And he had a lot of tragedy in his life, too.
Tragedy in his life. Yeah, his parents died, his brother died. He was an orphan ward at the age of 8 and, didn't have wealth until later in his career. But other than that, he's who you would want as a doctor. And that's why it was really important, and I was very lucky to find Miggs, who is his sort of counterpoint throughout the book. He really helps. He was the chair of obstetrics at the same university that Mutter was the chair of surgery, and they were philosophically and ideologically opposites at the same time, teaching the same groups of students. So their clashes are really interesting, and Miggs was so hugely popular and influential and, robust with 9 children while Mutter was frail and sickly with no children, and Mutter was the youngest member of the faculty and Miggs was the oldest, and it was really interesting watching both of their lives unfold because Miggs seemed to be on the wrong side of history and yet applauded for his opinions, while Mutter was on the right side of history and was pilloried for them. And, it's sort of interesting at the end when Mutter dies, long before many of his theories could be proven true by tools of science that would be, invented decades after his death. Meanwhile, Miggs certainly lived long enough to see all of his ideas that he had fought so, blindly be proven wrong. So it's a really interesting parallel that I felt, really lucky to find. This is why I love nonfiction, because so many times truth is stranger than fiction, and to find a Mutter and a Miggs story, paralleling at the same time in the same faculty was pretty miraculous.
Well, now, who was related to Benjamin Franklin? Was that Miggs?
That was Franklin Bosch, who was Miggs's essential best friend.
Okay, so...
Miggs was from a very, very long line of Miggs's. And they were sort of cantankerous upstarts and always starting fist fights with terrible tempers. They should be a book upon themselves. They're really fascinating. And there actually is still Dr. Miggs's in medical practice today in Philadelphia.
Interesting. There's so many interesting parts about this book, just reading some of the ways they treated people or what it was like back then. And you just think of, wow. If only they had it today, how many people would still be alive, they didn't know a lot of stuff back then.
Even something as simple as washing your hands or tools. It wasn't that they didn't know to do it, which they certainly didn't, but you had professors like Miggs who spoke out against it. He said that to insist a doctor wash his hands prior to meeting with a patient is to, quote, imply that doctors weren't gentlemen, because gentlemen... all gentlemen are clean men. So, that to me, it's one thing to be, not have put it all together. You can't blame people in the past for not understanding, correlation or causation. But to literally, have, people say, no, you should wash your hands and your tools to prevent infection and the spread of disease, and here's our theories behind it, and they're pretty compelling, and have people just ignore it. was, really shocking. And they would continue to ignore it for decades until the, invention of the modern microscope. And when you could finally say, here's bacteria, here are viruses, here's how they grow, this is how diseases are spread, then, you know, that, you know, knocked out all sort of personal opinion. But until then, it was literally personal opinion against personal opinion, which must have been absolutely enraging to those who were on the right side, knowing innately what was true, but not having the tools yet to prove it.
Right, exactly. What, just all the stuff you learned about Mutter, did you like him? When you,
oh, absolutely. I love that whole time period. You know, I think that, you know, I don't have a background in 19th century, you know, history or medicine, right?
I mean, was he arrogant too? I mean, was he?
Sure. But I mean, everyone's got flaws. You know, I don't think that you would want a person who was perfect.
Right.
But, you know, what he did was sort of, you know, was a human being, but he was so passionate about his views. And, you know, I think his arrogance and his, you know, not short temper. I mean, he wouldn't suffer fools who didn't agree with him, which served him in no way in the very politically charged world of 19th century medicine, where you kind of needed to be, you know, friendly and on good terms with a number of doctors to achieve any sort of prominence. You know, he just ignored all of that and suffered for it. I mean, Mutter is not as well known today for a number of reasons, but one of them was that, you know, he died very young and the people of power just still didn't like him, so they didn't give him the respect that he truly deserved and, you know, allowed his legacy to sort of dissolve away. And so I'm really happy to be the one who gets to bring him back into the spotlight, because I certainly think he deserves it.
What do you think of this book? You can only imagine how moved he would be by all the research that you did. And it's obvious you did quite a bit of research to write this book. I mean, this must have taken a long time to write.
Yeah, I mean, it was about 14 years from when I first stepped into the archive, and obviously that wasn't solid time spent. I did a year-long residency at the University of Pennsylvania, and that proved to be the bulk of the research done for the book, as opposed to the screenplay. It was originally a screenplay. But it was, you know, it was really fun, you know, in its own way to, you know, see things, threads coming up and themes that you want to chase and find the archives and libraries that would hold the answers to. It made me feel a little like Indiana Jones.
You should do an A&E biography of him. I can imagine how interesting that would be.
I would love to you know, move him towards a more visual medium, like a TV or documentary film or, you know, narrative film. That would be amazing. But we'll see.
You never know. You know, now that the book's out and it's getting all this attention, you know, and what are people saying about the book, by the way? I mean, what kind of letters are you getting about it? And what kind of attention are you getting?
Well, I was really nervous. You know, the hardcover came out last fall, and, you know, I think that you prepare yourself for the worst, so I thought that people would say, like, who is this girl? You know, her only other history was a contemporary poetry slam history, and, you know, she's a poet. And I was thrilled to see that it received really amazing reviews from NPR, from Wall Street Journal. It was named one of the best books of the year by NPR Science Friday, by Amazon, the UK newspaper The Guardian, The Onion's AV Club. You know, they wrote about it in Nature magazine and Smithsonian magazine and Penthouse. So it really got out there in a way that I certainly wasn't expecting. And people were just, you know, really, you know, seemed to connect with the passion that I have for the material. You know, the whole time period to me is really interesting. They were kind of like the MacGyvers of medicine. You know, they didn't have so many of the tools that we take for granted. So it would be not unlike if someone just gave you a knife, a saw, and a person whose leg needed to be chopped off and said, all right, figure this one out yourself. I mean, that's basically how they did it. You know, they didn't have any sort of tools to track blood pressure or syringes or x-rays. Or, you know, electric lighting. You know, it's pretty, and we now at least know to wash our hands and tools. They weren't even positive on whether or not to do that. So to sort of watch from this very almost primitive, but like intellectually vigorously primitive, you know, like the people were really trying hard to understand to get the platform that we now know to be modern medicine, starting with the discovery of ether anesthesia, which happened during Mutter's lifetime, and he in fact was the first doctor to use ether anesthesia in Philadelphia, and then moving from there, it was really amazing. And so I think I had a big enthusiasm for the work I was creating, and it was really wonderful to see people react with that same enthusiasm.
Now, have you ever seen an autopsy?
Not live, no.
Would you ever go into medicine in the future?
No. I'm a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer.
Well, a lot of doctors are writers too, you know.
I have a brother-in-law who's a doctor.
One doctor in the family is enough?
Yes. Let him take it. He's like a professor. He's pretty esteemed too. So I'll just continue with the writing thing. But no, I'm not. The inspiration for the book is, Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City was this first book I read that sort of looked at American history through the lens of, this very specific time, place, and people. And that's what I really wanted to do with this book. It's not so much, you don't need to necessarily have an interest in medicine to read Dr. Mutter's Marvels, but rather, if you're interested in just American history, to where we came from, and sort of the weirder, grosser things that maybe they don't talk about in classrooms when you were a kid, I really just love getting a better understanding of where we came from and, to get to where we are now through the lens of something as specific as a person or a time, a medicine, seeing American history through the lens of American medicine, and specifically this one person who was this outlier who worked in this really outlier plastic surgery in the severely deformed in the time before anesthesia genre, but it really unlocked so much about how we viewed each other, how we viewed women, how we viewed people of different races, different classes, and all through this one lens. So I like doing that, and that's more of the nonfiction that I'm going to be doing will be sort of explorations of a greater history through the lens of these micro histories.
Well, it's interesting that at one point they compare him to P.T. Barnum, who was a great showman. So was Mutter really a showman? Did he love performing in front of people?
Certainly. I mean, you have a surgical theater, and he certainly liked attention. So he wore very brightly colored outfits, pink silks, blue silks, at a time when everyone else was wearing these Quaker blacks and browns, and, performed these very daring surgeries that were never being done before.
And he didn't know the result that it would be, did he? I mean, was he just doing it what he thought was right? And, I mean, how did he know the patient wouldn't die during the surgery?
I mean, he really worked hard to create surgeries that, built upon existing research and existing surgeries that worked, and then just took it incrementally steps farther down to help attend the needs of people who were incrementally worse off than the previous patients that had had successful surgeries. So he spent a lot of time devising surgeries, and also a lot of time in preoperative care and postoperative care. One of the more amazing things I came across in my research was that the death rates for patients who were under ether during their surgery, so rendered unconscious, and the death rates of patients who were awake during their surgery, so literally thrashing on a table and screaming, were pretty much exactly the same. Because it wasn't the surgeries themselves that were the killers, it was the infection that would take hold after. And Mutter was fastidiously clean at a time when that was not done. And so, half of his success rates for his surgeries were simply that he was a clean doctor and had recovery rooms to ensure that his wounds, the wounds of his patients would stay clean and uninfected, while other surgeons just sent them home and they would just die there. So it's, that was half the battle, more than half the battle, was preoperative and postoperative care for his patients. The surgeries themselves, I think he was more confident that he could get it done quickly enough that they wouldn't die of blood loss. But after that, then it's really, will it stick and will it not, blacken and fallen off because of infection?
What's really amazing is how dangerous it was to have children back then. And pregnancies were very dangerous back then. And I think, was it Miggs that had 10 kids? One of them.
Yeah, Miggs had 10 kids.
Well, how dangerous was that, you know, for his wife to have 10 children?
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, some of them really lucked out. John Tyler, who was a president roughly around that time period, he had 15 kids.
Did he really?
Spread over two wives. Yeah, spread over two wives. So, but it's amazing that women survived at all. I mean, it was a really terrible business. And their children died at alarming rates. So you would go through these horrible pregnancies, these birthing processes, and then they would, you know, die of infection because their obstetrician wasn't washing their hands prior to, you know, touching your newborn baby's head. And, it makes me so grateful for birth control. I'll be honest with you. I've been doing more research. Women's history in particular is always of interest to me. And, I always say that, you know, I think we're going to look back on time and be able to be like BC, AD, and then ABC, you know, like after birth control. Because the moment that we gave women the ability to choose when and if they want to have children was such a completely revolutionary thing to happen to the humankind, and allowed women to choose how they want to be in society as opposed to just being relegated to, you know, whatever biology dictated. Because, I mean, it wasn't even, they didn't even understand how babies were made back in the 19th century, which seemed shocking. I mean, they obviously knew that it was, you know, sperm meets egg, but, right. You know, when, you know, how, the development, they just did not understand it. I mean, that's a big portion of the book is the concept of this point when, the quickening, where God touches the woman's womb and animates the, up until then, the thought to be non-living fetus in her body, and then that prior to the quickening, prior to when she could feel the baby move, it was, you know, abortion was absolutely legal because they didn't consider it to be alive yet. It was only when the mother could feel it that it was considered to be an actual, you know, so I mean, these are doctors whose entire, you know, livelihood is studying this, and even they didn't understand how the development of a fetus happened. So I mean, it's one thing to have birth control, it's a whole other thing to have, like, no idea how this stuff works and be totally lost. It's really fascinating. But, it was pretty grim business.
What was the most surprising thing you learned about Dr. Mutter in all your research?
I really liked his gumption. I liked that he would constantly, you know, I loved that when he was a kid, he wanted to dress more flamboyantly than his budget would allow, so he figured out that he could charge his clothing bill to his boarding school and just, you know, as like a school supply, and then work and then get scholarships, academic scholarships to pay off his clothing bills. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought for a 14-year-old, that was pretty sophisticated thinking to get, like, cigars and silk ties and gingham cravats and, all the weird things he was buying as a 14-year-old. But in terms of, you know, just the story in general, I definitely think Fosse Jaw is something that has really stuck with me, the idea that, you know, girls, well, I was working in an Army Navy, the I. Goldberg's Army Navy store to pay, you know, for stuff when I was in high school, that girls who were my age and from my neighborhood were going into these factories and having their entire faces sort of torn open by chemicals until they glowed in the dark. That was sort of, and that it was common enough to have a nickname, that was probably something that would stuck with me for a long, long time.
Now, he never had any children, or did he?
He did not. He had no children. People always ask me about how he died. And at the time, they said he died of hereditary gout, which isn't really fatal. Commonly, people have assumed that he's died of tuberculosis, which is, you know, he has had pulmonary issues his entire life. But there is a theory that he may have had congenital syphilis, which he would have received from his parents, and that was what thought may have killed his family. And though he survived the illness in childhood, that it rendered him sterile, and that's why he had no children. But no one really knows. I mean, pathology that would allow sort of a determination of that sort of sophistication to be done would not be invented until the modern microscope came around.
Now, how many people go to the modern museum today? I mean, is it well?
I think it's over like 180,000 annually.
Wow.
It is the most popular science museum in the United States for the demographic of 18 to 35, which kind of makes sense. I mean, if you go to science museums, typically they're geared towards young children. You know, like, how does the heart work? What is evolution? And the Mutter Museum really is, again, that curiosity-based style of learning, which I don't think is typical. You know, it doesn't, you know, I mean, they'll have exhibitions, like, on the, you know, deaths of presidents, or right now they have this really wonderful one about Civil War medicine, and they also have a really great one about fairy tales and how the deformities and disfigurements that are so common in fairy tales, where they get their, you know, how they were actually health conditions that were from that time, from the time period that these fairy tales were being created, that we just doesn't exist anymore, which is really fascinating to think about. So they have exhibitions, but for the most part, it's just objects. And you just are drawn to an object, and then you pause, and you learn about it, and, you know, and then you move on. So it really is a sort of a more sophisticated sort of type of museum than science museums are used to, and a little more graphic as well.
How many?
And so it really brings in.
How many displays do they have at the museum? I wonder. I'm looking at the pictures of the museum.
I have no idea. I mean, they've got two solid floors and then a separate exhibition hall. But the cabinets themselves are just crammed with items. So it really just, you know, I'm not sure what would count as a separate display.
Now, these were all things that he had, Mutter himself? These were all in his possession?
The Mutter Museum was founded with his original collection, but since then there's been a lot of additions, and mostly they all fall into the category of, you know, doctors who were, similar to Mutter, obsessed with one particular part of medicine and collected around it. So you have the sort of famous Hurdle skull collection, which is, 120 some odd skulls collected from all around the world, and the basic biographical information as well as cause of death is written onto the side of the skull in ink. And it was essentially one doctor who was obsessed with disproving the idea of phrenology, the idea that you can know a person's morality and personality through the ridges of his skull. And he disproved it, and now that entire collection is at the Mutter Museum. We have another one. Chevalier Jackson was a general practitioner who was specialized in removing things that were trapped in the throats of people. And he provided that service for free, provided he was allowed to keep the object after removing it. And so if you go to the Mutter Museum, you have these drawers and drawers of drawers and drawers of carefully cataloged items that had been, you know, pulled from the throats of men, women, and children, and you can actually page through his original book to see, you know, you look at the item, oh, this is item 256. You go to the book, find 256. It was an attendance pin taken from the throat of a five-year-old girl, and she survived. Not everyone survived, unfortunately. But, again, just one sort of obsessive doctor who helped, you know, sort of transform that small niche part of medicine. And that museum is sort of filled with those sorts of obsessions. So it's really neat.
Hmm. You're really fascinated by all this. And I find that fascinating myself. Women are not squeamish anymore. It seems that there was a time when they were. I mean, you don't seem very squeamish at all. None of this stuff really...
I had my moments. There's parts of the museum that, there's this... I still have no idea what it's called, but I call it the wall of eye trauma. It's just a wall of eyeballs with horrible things that have happened to them. And that's the one part of the museum I cannot look at very long. So even to this day, there's things that still ick me out. But for the most part, you know, once you understand the science behind these things, they become really fascinating. You understand them not as sort of tools to shock or disgust, but as medical, you know, part of a medical history, and to understand their place in it is to really appreciate it. And I find that kind of stuff really interesting.
Was Mutter compassionate to his patients?
Absolutely. You know, he was, you know, these people that he worked on were frequently hidden from society. They were shames to their family, particularly the women. He specialized in severely burned women that you'll see a lot in the book. And these women were hidden, not allowed to see the general public at all because the shame that having a deformed woman in the family would bring. So he was hugely compassionate and warm and engaging to a wide variety of people. And one of the stories that really touched me the most was a student of his wrote in a journal about how he brought in a man with severe elephantitis, so, you know, kind of like elephant's man's disease, and was unable to work. And after Mutter, you know, explained the disease and what he was offering to do to help, he then passed like a pan around and said, you know, our roles as doctors is not just to treat the symptoms or the problem, but to take care of the human being who is suffering. And this is a man who is now unable to work because of situations beyond his control, his health. He did not cause this. This is something that happened to him. So I would ask you to, if you have extra money, to put it into this, and we're going to give it to him so that he can survive, you know, without having to beg on the streets or do anything that brings shame to himself. Yeah, you know, before we have these surgeries scheduled. So, I mean, just that's unreal. At that same time, you know, Duprienne, who was a really famous surgeon in France, would literally lead the patients in his surgical clinics into the surgical amphitheater by sticking his fingers into their nostrils and yanking them into the center and then pushing them down onto their knees as he discussed their problems. I mean, that's how dehumanizing he treated his patients. And at the same time, you have Mutter, who is literally collecting funds and explaining that, you know, that it's whole medicine, you know, and whole care for people, not just solving this problem. So he was really fascinating, and I hope that people really get a deep understanding of that by reading, you know, Dr. Mutter's marvels. Just what a fascinating, strange, bizarre, arrogant, but compassionate man he was, and he died way, way too young. But I'm really happy to be bringing his legacy back into the spotlight with this book.
And there was a book a number of years ago, I remember it was in the Barnes & Noble, and it was a picture book of the Mutter Museum, and I remember looking through it, and you can't help but be disturbed as you close it and you think about all these things and you look at the pictures and, you're attracted to the pictures, but you're also repulsed. You can't help but feel a little bit of repulsion. I mean, that's just a normal reaction, I would think, of some people, but I just remember
that book was put together by Gretchen Warden, who was the woman who allowed me first access to the Mutter Museum, and she said, you know, about the pictures, that though these bodies may be ugly, that there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those who are forced to endure those inflictions. And so, you know, it's tough to watch, but they're still human beings.
Right.
You know, that was the thing that...
Well, I think that's what bothers you, knowing that these are real people, that these things really happened, and, you know, and what these poor people went through. You just feel this instant compassion when you see all these pictures. You know, your heart goes out to these people. You know, how did they survive? How did they live everyday life?
Yeah, and that's what, you know, made Mutter so incredibly unique, was that he thought this population that medicine at that time period had written off. I mean, there was just no treatment. You know, you were labeled a monster, and that was it for the rest of your life. And Mutter came in and devised surgeries and treatment plans to help, you know, reconstruct these people so that they could rejoin society in a way that had never been dreamed possible to previous generations of people who suffered the way they did. And it's pretty incredible what he did. I'm really proud of Mutter.
And what kind of crowds are you getting at your book signings?
Really great. I mean, it's you know, I'm sort of splitting between sort of stranger public events. I have events at the West Laurel Hill Cemetery and the International Museum of Surgical Science in Chicago, and upcoming events at the Morbid Anatomy Museum. I'm also doing a medical school, their bookstore, so Harvard, Johns Hopkins, University of Pennsylvania, In addition to sort of traditional independent bookstores like Pals and Book People in Austin. And it's interesting, you know, it's really, you know, when I had the hardcover come out, you know, I have the task of introducing Mooter to people. And some people, you know, in the Philly area, they know the Mooter Museum. And as you get farther away from Philly, the less that becomes resonant. So I was really grateful for the amount of press that the book did receive, that it drew audiences in who were just curious about the, you know, the subject matter. And now that I'm on the paperback tour, it really helped that it, you know, was a New York Times bestseller and it was on the list for 3 months. So to have that on the front of the cover is really helpful. And it's really great to meet with people who've already read the book. And, you know, so I'm getting a lot of, like, can you sign my hardcover? And I brought these three friends, and they're all buying the paperback. So that's really thrilling, and that makes it, you know, a really unique experience.
It's a shame you can't do an event at the museum itself and show people all the different things. That would be really cool.
Both my hardcover, the hardcover and paperback launches were both held at the museum.
Oh, you did have that. Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, so, yeah, you save a lot on catering because no one wants to eat.
How many people showed up? I'm curious.
You know, the first one was a private event because I was later going to be doing my big public event at the Free Library, the author event series. But this most recent one was a public event, and it was about like 140 people.
Okay, so very cool.
Very cool. Special.
Glad to hear that. And it's been great to talk to you. I know you have to go and do some other stuff. So the book again is called
Thanks so much for chatting with me, David.
Yeah, it's been
and
nice.
And if people have any questions, I'm going to be on tour for the next few weeks. They can look at my website, which is apduits.com. That's A, P as in Peter, T as in Tom, O, W, I, C as in Cat, Z as in Zebra.com. I have all of my tour dates listed there. I have an author page on Facebook under Kristen O'Keefe Apduits, and you can follow me on Twitter at CO Apduits. I also update all of my tour dates there as well.
And what are you working on now? What's the next book going to be about? Do you have any idea?
I do. It's another historical nonfiction. It's a little gorier than Mooter, so that's all I can say about it, because I've got to wait for it to sell first. Right now it's in the proposal. But I'll be announcing it once the book is sold on my website and social media, so people can find out there.
And once again, the book's called Dr. Mooter's Marvels. It's out from Avery, which is a division of Penguin. And it's only $17, so it's really inexpensive. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much, David. Have a great day.
And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.